so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Michael Hirsch, who's a longtime friend of mine. He's a senior correspondent for Foreign Policy Magazine, previously foreign editor for Newsweek, and a national editor for Politico. He's written a number of books. One I remember well, Capital Offense, about Washington and its relationship to Wall Street. And he wrote a book earlier called At War With Ourselves, which sounds an awful lot like America Right Now, but I don't think that was what the title was about. It was related to the United States and its relationship to the world. Mike, thanks for joining me.
Oh, happy to be here, Rob.
So we've just finished the presidential election, and Joe Biden looks like he will, the courts have backed things down, and looks like he will become the president. I'm very interested in your experience of the Trump years, and what you see on the horizon, the challenges, I want to say, so that the Biden years don't lead us to a next phase of Trump years, but we evolve beyond and what's necessary. But let's start with, why do you think America elected Donald Trump? What was happening in our political economy that brought us to that point? And created so much turmoil in these last 4 years?
Well, we all remember the shock win of 2016 and a Hillary Clinton campaign that virtually every expert thought would roll into the White House. And I think the genesis of her defeat was not Russian meddling, was not her personality, or even, the email scandal. All of those were contributing factors. But I think it was her failure to understand where the Democratic Party had gone so wrong. And one of the great ironies is that she had that message really sort of wrapping her between the eyes virtually every month in the form of Bernie Sanders winning a number of primaries and indeed coming somewhat close to defeating her for the nomination. And the message of Bernie Sanders was that the politics had shifted dramatically away from where they were during, say, Bill Clinton's presidency. Bernie Sanders is a guy that, has been in Washington for decades, and for most of that time, no one ever listened to him. He spoke to empty rooms. Whether he was in the House, or the Senate, he was the token socialist. And all of a sudden, the entire country and indeed the base of the Democratic Party is listening to him. Why? Because the Democratic centrists who rose up after the Reagan period, you remember Bill Clinton came in famously saying, we can't consider the government, to be the solution to every problem. The Democrats had moved toward the center and ran a pace into globalization in terms of opening up capital markets, opening up trade, NAFTA and other trade agreements. And the economists knew this was going to create distributional problems in terms of people losing their jobs here. But they kind of thought, well, the politicians will realize that and take care of it and set up new education and training programs that would help these devastated communities that were suffering from the China shock, mainly competition from China, but other countries as well that were opening up all at once after the Cold War, that the politicians, particularly the Democrats, would figure out a way to help these people, and they didn't. I covered 8 years of Bill Clinton, and I can tell you the administration barely held a meeting on the fate of the dispossessed in some of these devastated communities. Now, fast forward to the 2016 election, Hillary loses. How does she lose? She loses the so-called blue wall in these very states where you have these devastated communities, where the industrial middle class had been growing frustrated with the party, therefore supporting Sanders. And I think what happened was Trump, in his very crude way, saw this anger. Saw the fact that, and you watched him knock off 17 Republican rivals in his own primaries because they were also establishment figures who backed the same broad consensus for free trade, globalization, and so forth. And then he went after the, angry Democrats in key states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, which is why Hillary lost. So this is all a sort of long-winded way of saying that the polarization began because neither party in the last two decades since Ronald Reagan has been up to the challenge of dealing with the pitfalls of free trade, globalization, what happened to a once stable middle class. And that is exactly what Biden is grappling with. He's openly grappling with it. His top advisors have said so. Jake Sullivan, who's going to be his national security advisor, wrote a very interesting article last year in The Atlantic saying that, they never really held meetings on the fate of the middle class during the Obama administration even. And Obama, of course, was seen as a reformer, but he disappointed many people in that respect. So that's essentially what you've got here, Rob. You got a broad-based anger that crosses party lines in many respects that Trump exploited, but being Trump, and really, in my view, completely unfit for the presidency, I think that he botched it in many ways. Of course, he was sidelined by the COVID pandemic, without which he might have actually won re-election. But that's what you have. Populism rules because the party traditional establishments failed.
I think about this in the context of economic theory. The notion that globalization is the culprit is in marked contrast to what economists say, that free trade can make everyone better off, and no one being worse off, that there are net gains. But I guess what I would say is that the distribution of those gains,
right,
have to be spread through things like adjustment assistance, re-education, etc., in order to realize the promise that everyone will be better off. And in the data, it seems quite contradictory.
Yeah.
And I think other impetus like the growth of technology, automation, machine learning, while they may hold great potential for the future, those same distributional fears about who will make money and who owns what and who will lose money affected the enthusiasm for both, I would say positively, for both Trump and Sanders. And Trump, well, I would say in 2015, 2016, that I'm from Detroit, Michigan, he's running around that state saying the system is rigged. 39,000 people are showing up in Lansing in a football stadium in the rain to cheer for that message.
Right.
He gave a talk to the Economics Club of Detroit and said, management in the auto industry ought to be ashamed because they cost so many jobs in America. Now, it may have been theater, but you hadn't seen politicians come in and point a finger at CEOs in Detroit in a long time.
Yeah.
So I think... And Sanders also won the primary. So while they have marked differences, the similarities of how their message connected appear to be very, very strong.
Yeah.
But I also think there's another dimension, and I'm curious your thoughts here. With globalization, you have someone who's an elected local official, and he might be right to tell people, curtail your wage demands. Otherwise, capital's going to get up with wings and fly off to a place, say in Asia or Latin America or the Middle East or what have you, that has fewer environmental restrictions, lower wages, lower regulation, their profit margin will be higher. But then that local politician looks like he works for that narrow segment of capital, he doesn't look like he works for the people in the community, even if he was right.
Yeah.
So how does globalization work with the notion of governance and the responsibility of protecting people? Have we figured that out? Have we got a sense of how it works?
No, I assume that's one of the things you're working on now with your fellow economists. But from everything I've heard, traditional macroeconomics is in turmoil. There was an interesting book that came out, I think, earlier this year by Benjamin Applebaum of the New York Times called The Economist's Hour, in which he critiques what happened to policymaking going back to the 60s when people began listening to economists as if they were, oracles, Delphic in nature. And social welfare took a back seat. Not every country, operated in this way. I spent 4 years reporting in Japan in the early to middle 90s. And despite all the criticism of Japan's many economic mistakes in the years since, they have never viewed economics in that way. They've always viewed it through the lens of social stability. Hence the famous Japanese methods of lifetime work, which has been attenuated somewhat, but a lot of the system remains intact. And they also didn't let their financial system, which was at the time considered antiquated, run wild either. And so you had capital controls. And you've seen, in Europe as well, for example, Germany, it also was not a place that became hostage to free market economic thinking, that made social welfare and social stability and equality part of the equation. And so I think that's one reason why globalization became so controversial in this country, particularly during the Trump era, but leading up to it as well, and not as much of a controversy. Free trade is not as much of a controversy in those other countries. So I think we have to learn some lessons from that. And you're right to say that this is a very complex issue. It's not simply globalization, it's technology. There are a lot of reasons why we are suffering from the loss of our middle class and this huge inequality. A lot of it has to do with Wall Street, which I went into, in the book you cited earlier. But what is clear is that every expert you talk to, economic or political scientists, professional politicians, are in the process of rethinking this right now. I mention the article that Jake Sullivan wrote? Jake Sullivan is going to be Biden's national security advisor. He basically wrote, we have to completely rethink the way liberal internationalism is organized. So I think you're going to see a lot of new thinking. Whether it's going to work or not, we don't know.
And Professor Eikenberry at Princeton, you just wrote a review of his new book as well. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
And you shared that with me a week or so ago.
I was told by a very senior member of the incoming administration that the Eikenberry book, which is called A World Safe for Democracy, has become something of a manifesto. Because Eikenberry, since a wonderful book he wrote a couple decades ago called After Victory, has really become perhaps the leading scholar of liberal internationalism in the U.S. And he has a new book just out, in which he goes back over 200 years, all the way back really to the Age of Enlightenment, but 200 years of building up the liberal international system and the ways it's changed. And he notes, as many other observers and scholars have noted, that we started not to pay attention to the idea of a shared community of nations, which it was founded on. And really, it kind of became more like a public utility exploited by major multinational corporations and Wall Street, and created this situation where, as you alluded to, capital had the entire globe to roam at will freely, and labor was kind of stuck here in its devastated communities. And I think a very uneven bargaining a relationship ended up happening, where it's one of the reasons you don't see the power, I think, of labor to demand higher wages and why wages have remained so flat. Again, it's complicated, I know, and there are many different economic explanations for it, but I do think that's one of the broad strokes historically of what's happened.
I think one of my concerns has been what I call the commodification of social design. And what I mean by that is you have globalization, or you have technology, or you have issues related to migration. But then those who make money are able to use that money, in part because of court decisions, for lobbying, campaign contributions, trying to influence appointments, enforcement, and what have you. And among other things, what used to be called tax evasion, keeping your money offshore, started to be called tax avoidance.
Right.
And that capital could just stay offshore, or companies could put their money in Ireland or wherever. And we got to a place where we didn't really, how would I say, if you aggregated everything in the gross national product, the economy was much bigger, but we kept saying we can't afford it. And the infrastructure, the school systems, and various different parts of, how I say, the rungs in the ladder of opportunity started to disintegrate. Yeah. And I think people were demoralized. Trump and Bernie both sang that song. But then when Donald Trump becomes the president of the United States, what did he do? Deregulated, moved away from climate change, and cut taxes for the most wealthy and powerful even further.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to be sympathetic, you'd say, well, he understood the system and what it needed.
Yeah.
He understood when he started the bailouts related to the pandemic that maybe what he needed to do was make sure all his donors were taken care of, not the citizens.
Yeah.
But then we're really getting to the question of the democracy becoming a plutocracy and whether you or I could envision, or the Biden administration could envision, or Kamala Harris could envision the right thing to do. The question is, can you survive in a position of leadership doing the right thing when the countervailing power of money is so profound?
You know, it's going to be a really hard fight. One of the reasons we really don't know how much Biden can get done is because we still don't know what's going to happen in the Senate. The Georgia Senate races will determine that. And if the Democrats win, then you have a House and a Senate effectively controlled by the Democrats. You have an emerging consensus among economists, including those coming into the Biden administration, but on the Democratic side in the House as well, that we need to do massive stimulus. We can afford to do massive stimulus because because interest rates remain so low and will continue to. The old macroeconomic thinking about massive deficit spending, crowding out private investment, is no longer as true. That massive stimulus program, which I hope will be coming, will need to invest in public goods. It will need to invest in smart green technologies, in education. It will need to address the underlying sources that you just diagnosed and unwind what has become, this plutocracy. I don't know whether it will work. You're aware of a very famous book by Mansur Olson called The Logic of Collective Action, which, sort of said you get this gradual accretion of lobbyists and interest groups in Washington, and they continue to dominate the broader public interest, which has no representatives. And I think, that's one of the things we've seen. One of the reasons I wrote my book called Capital Offense was to describe the process by which Wall Street firms, which really had been kept in line, back in the 60s and 70s, the SEC was very powerful. There was a completely different atmosphere until you get, some of the so-called government Sachs types Robert Rubin and all the others coming in and essentially representing the interests of Wall Street. Of course, this is one of the things that got Hillary in so much trouble in 2016 because she gave a couple of those, you know, funded speeches to some of the big to Goldman and another big investment firm. So I think it's very complex. Can we, you know, the problems go so deep, the lobbying interests are so powerful that you are going to need not only a president who's aware of this, an administration is aware of this, and I think in Biden we have that even more than we had with Obama. We will have a president who's aware of these problems. But you're going to have that resistance on Capitol Hill. And if the Republicans do manage to take back the Senate with Mitch McConnell in charge, you're going to see the same kind of obstructionism you saw during the Obama years. It's going to be ugly. So a lot of America's future right now, now hangs on a few thin threads in the state of Georgia, I would say. And then, of course, that would raise questions about what happens in 2024. Depending on how much Biden succeeds with his program versus how much he's obstructed.
But I think there's a very interesting lesson to learn from the Obama years, which was, from my perspective, and you know I worked both in the Republican and Democratic parties in different times on Capitol Hill, I saw Obama aspiring, in a good intention, to be a healer, a unifier.
Yeah.
But when they were cutting his knees out and defeating many of his policies or modifying them in ways that, how would I say, were not progressive, he didn't pick a fight.
Yeah.
And so I look at Biden. He's a little more like Lyndon Johnson. He's been in the trenches. He's fought the battles. He knows how to twist arms down in the back rooms.
Exactly.
And he's a little bit more, perhaps, endowed with the experience of Franklin Roosevelt, which is this pandemic in this prolonged time since the great financial crisis and the wildness and disorientation people associate with the Trump experience. It's almost like everybody knows things got to change now.
Yeah.
And so the question, this is my question for you. Let's say the Republicans hold on to one of those Georgia seats and the majority. How do you go to work with Mitch McConnell? Because if he can stall everything out, people will say, oh my God, it's all stagnant and everything fell apart. And he, and the Republicans say, why did you guys put these people in office?
Yeah.
On the other hand, if McConnell is the obstacle and you shine a floodlight on him, you can say, folks, now you can see why we got to get rid of these guys and accelerate what you might call a new progressive coalition. But it's going to take a little more boldness and confrontation than Obama, in my view. Well, how do you see it?
No, I agree with you completely. And, you know, one of Obama's flaws, people said that he was too young, too inexperienced. And in some respects, it was true. He was a wonderful speechmaker, charismatic figure, but he'd only been a senator for, you know, 2 years. And then before that, he was a state senator for a brief time. He didn't have the schmooze gene, as my former Newsweek colleague, Jonathan Alter, said in a book that he wrote about Obama. There was a sense that he just didn't have enough experience reaching across the aisle. Now, there were other factors to the obstructionism of the Tea Party, Mitch McConnell, and before him, you know, John Boehner, when he was House Speaker, and you had all of those standoffs over the budget and the debt. And I think racism has to be said. I think there was certainly a racist factor. That was another reason for Trump, you know, all the dog whistling, literally from the moment he came down the escalator in Trump Tower and started talking about, you know, Mexicans as racist. There were a lot of Americans who were uncomfortable with a black president. And I think that a lot of these factors piled up. Obama's own timidity, if you will, in pushing Congress, as well as the resistance to him, that you're going to see a contrast to now. I mean, There is literally no better deal maker. Okay, maybe that's overstating it, but he is one of the great deal makers of the last several decades. This is a guy who's been in office since for 47 years, right? He cast his first vote during Vietnam. That's how far he goes back. During the 90s and the 2000s, and even during the Obama administration, he was a key person in getting a few Republican votes. In fact, he was key to getting the Recovery Act passed, if you may remember, in 2009, because Obama sent him to the Hill to negotiate. And he's also a longtime colleague of Mitch McConnell's. So even though I think the Republicans are going to remain somewhat Trumpized, I think the polarization is going to continue. There's going to be a lot of anger. There is a possibility that the old politics, the old political ways of Joe Biden might break the logjam in some respects. And you'll at least get some of the things that both Trump and the Democrats were saying from day one they wanted, for example, a giant infrastructure bill. They just couldn't get it done. You know, the relationship between Trump and Nancy Pelosi was too toxic, among other reasons. So I think President Biden knows what he needs to do. He needs to start spending a lot of money. He needs to start helping the disadvantaged. I think that the COVID pandemic has changed some Republican minds in terms of the utility of government, at times of crisis, and how really, you have no way to avoid both cooperation with other countries and government intervention. So who knows? The atmosphere could begin to change. The Trumpist hostility, the atmosphere that we've had for the last 4 years could begin to lift. I just can't say whether it will. We just had protests in D.C. the other night in which four people were stabbed after the Supreme Court decision that Trump's lawsuit against Texas in trying to invalidate the results in four other states, that would not be allowed, that it would not be adjudicated by the Supreme Court. So I think you're seeing the dying light right now, of any hope that Trump could somehow still pull this out, and with it, the dying some dying fealty anyway. I think among Republican establishment, although an amazing number of them. I mean, I'm just astonished at how many Republican establishment figures in Congress are lining up with him in challenging the election results even now.
The idea of creating what you might call the insinuation of a corrupt election may serve to impede the rebound of faith in governance.
Yeah.
And that's not only consistent with them coming to power, but it's consistent with some of their anti-government ideology that's been a pillar of the Republican agenda. But I think at this juncture, there are lots of things that are very, very tender. I've done research with a young man named Arjun Jayadev, where we studied the relationship geographically between indicators of racial animosity and indicators of economic despair or anxiety.
Yeah.
And what you find is the places where the economic distress was greatest is tightly correlated. And the variations up and down lead to up and down of what we call otherness or racial scapegoating. And Peter Temin, the famous MIT economist and economic historian, wrote a book in his work with INET called The Vanishing Middle Class. And it was about his concern that when racial animosity was poisoning the political dialogue, we couldn't agree on a proper, what you might call, infrastructure of opportunity, particularly vis-a-vis the education system, to elevate our country and strengthen our democracy.
Yeah.
Because we need all of our citizens to be educated and engaged. And so I see a lot of stress on the horizon, and particularly after Trump, as I mentioned, cut all the taxes and regulations for the powerful, I think he really hit the gas pedal on identity politics to foment greater polarity to keep his coalition together.
Yeah.
And how Trump or how Biden can heal that, I think, is an important challenge. And I will say, a lot of people have said to me recently who are historians and very knowledgeable, nobody expected FDR to be as great as he was, but the circumstances inspired him to rise to the occasion.
Yeah.
And so I think a person who looks at some of the bargains and votes and bipartisanship that Biden has engaged in could become despondent or cynical. But people who thought that FDR was a silver spoon rich guy from New York were quite surprised when he was, how do they say, the captain drawing us into battle.
Yeah.
So I think the circumstances are a call to action now.
Yeah.
And
The problem of otherness, the problem of underlying racism, the extent to which that poisoned our social welfare system is a very real problem. You and I have talked about Eduardo Porter's book, America Poisoned, which goes right to that point, saying that the social contract was essentially dismantled by hatred of middle-class whites for the others, for black and brown people, who were getting, you know, a substantial part of the benefit. And that was what underlay, in some ways, the Tea Party, what underlay the Trump movement. It's difficult to measure how much a factor that is. But, you know, we should be frank in saying, you know, racism and social volatility and identity politics, which is a euphemism for the same thing, are here to stay for a long time. And really, again, I think that Biden and his people are fully aware of this. They're aware of the genesis of these problems in a way that, frankly, the Hillary Clinton team was not, and even Obama was not. You know, you mentioned it. FDR, one of the reasons that FDR was able to overturn the economic system and establishment to such a degree as he did was not just the severity of the Depression, but also because he was from that class. You know, he came from the rich aristocratic establishment class and knew them through and through, you know. Whereas, say, Barack Obama, who, when he was running, you know, some thought would be the next FDR, was very much an outsider. So, and Biden is somewhere in the middle. You know, he's an elderly white guy, working class origins, but also from deep within the system and knows the system. So, you know, I just hope that we'll get to a point where the polarization doesn't go away, but where it becomes more ambient noise than the driving factor in decision-making.
On the research I mentioned with Jay Ottiv and myself, a vibrant and resilient recovery, taking some of the economic anxiety out of it, might, diminish the yearning for otherness.
Yeah.
And contribute to the healing.
Yeah.
And I myself really hope that this much more diverse set of appointments, both in racial and gender terms, can achieve the kind of vision analogous to the New Deal and contribute to that healing through their own, which you might call demonstrated empathy.
Yeah.
For the larger segment, broader segments of society who've been neglected in recent years.
Yeah, I you know, the Biden appointment so far, and he has pointed a lot of posts, is something of a mixed bag, and some progressives are disappointed. For example, with the appointment of Neera Tanden, you know, to run the Office of Management and Budget, which she's not particularly well qualified for, and she's also a centrist who angered many progressives over her criticisms of Bernie Sanders. But on the other hand, I think you've got some incredibly impressive people. I mean, Janet Yellen is not only a unifier. I mean, she was so well considered by Republicans that Trump suggested at one point he might even reappoint her. Of course, he didn't. But she's a brilliant economist. She was brilliant in the work she did at the Fed. But what fewer people know is she's also got an illustrious history as a labor economist who's written a lot of papers on inequality, the problem of inequality and the middle class. So you're going to have someone there who really knows the problem. You know, Cecilia Rouse, another great labor economist, head of the Council of Economic Advisors. So I think on the whole, progressives should be somewhat encouraged by some of the appointments. And of course, if you take a picture of them all, it does look a little bit like a multicultural dream team in terms of just color, right? I mean, you got, the first Black defense secretary in Lloyd Austin, Kamala Harris, of course, the first Black Indian American vice president and first woman. You have a lot of different, Cecilia Rouse is a Black woman. So, you do have a pretty good looking diverse crew so far that I think on the whole is a positive sign.
Mm-hmm. And I would underscore your affirmation of the appointment of Janet Yellen, who I agree is an outstanding leader and not the kind of egotist that some leaders are. So she collaborates brilliantly.
Yeah.
And she's deeply intellectual. She also has dinner with a very brilliant guy almost every night named George Akerlof.
Yes.
Who's one of the most creative influences in helping me set the agenda for INET over the years.
Really? Well, and, Nobel Prize winner, and I think actually one of her best known papers she co-wrote with him.
That's right.
Way back
that's
then.
That's right.
Yeah.
But George has been writing about identity economics as well. His most recent work with Rachel Krasner is quite, how would I say, it's a powerful contribution without being hostile or, picking a fight. He's putting a vision up with identity economics that makes you ask different questions and perhaps addresses some of the blind spots that the economics profession can rightly be accused of having had.
Well, it seems to me that the macroeconomics, of course, was born as a field during crisis, the Great Depression, and I think a lot of rethinking needs to go. Obviously, a lot more behavioral economics, new microeconomic thinking about individual decision making and what happened to some of these economies. I'm talking about these community economies that were devastated by the China shock. I think you would know better than I do because you're an economist and I'm not. But my impression from talking to a lot of these people is that the field is in a complete state of rethinking and reinvention and new economic thinking to take your the title of your own institution.
Yeah, well, I do think it's a promising time in the sense that we do have some very severe results for large proportions of some of the people that live in these so-called democracies. And I think the hypothetical notion that politics and economics are separable is also an illusion.
Yeah.
And which you've done a beautiful job of dispelling through all of the different writings and books you've done over the years.
Thank you.
Let me ask you a little bit more about the international elements of this. What do you see as the major foreign policy challenges that are on the horizon for the Biden administration and America at large?
I would say the top three are China, China, and China. rethinking the relationship with China, the rising superpower, by some measures, about the largest economy in the world now, or close to it, close to us, is critical. One of the illusions that has been shattered, Rob, I think, in the last couple of decades, particularly since that period of post-Cold War hubris, when Francis Fukuyama famously suggested maybe the end of history because liberal democracy seems to work so well. I think that what has been dispelled is the illusion that there is some perfect system, that, you know, a revolution of some kind can lead to the perfect political slash economic system. And that was the illusion that so many policymakers had about China for the past 25 years or so. Really, well, more than that, since they opened up their economy, was that they would be gradually, through being members of the WTO, they'd be co-opted into the international system. The hopes after Tiananmen Square were dashed, but there was a sense that Chinese just wanted to get rich, and the richer and more educated you are, the more you yearn for democracy, and, you know, all would go well there. And that's just, you know, that illusion is really gone. And what we have to recognize is two very politically different systems have to learn to coexist. It's not the Cold War, because we're no longer really trying to make the Chinese like us in terms of democracy. We are trying to change their economic behavior and their financial behavior, but, you know, we're not really trying to turn them into a just Jeffersonian democracy, and they're certainly not out there, you know, evangelizing the way the communists did in the USSR. So it's a question of finding a way to coexist and looking the other way at some things. And yes, criticizing the horrible crackdown in Hong Kong, of course, you have to do that if you're a free country, but not necessarily letting that turn into a Cold War. And returning to what I think was a very well-negotiated agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was specifically designed to exclude and pressure China into accepting and embracing norms for, you know, intellectual property protection and, you know, non-dumping provisions that the Chinese ignored after they joined the WTO. And so it needs to be a partnership. Again, another argument for a reinvented kind of liberal internationalism led by the U.S. is that's really the only way to deal with China. We need it. It's not going to happen bilaterally. And if we can do it that way without, you know, being too aggressive, too interventionist in the way that, say, we were, I think, after the Cold War toward the Russians, which I think led to the rise of Putin and his own brand of neo-nationalism. If we do it in a smart enough way, I think that we can find a way to, you know, to coexist. I did a piece not long ago on Barry Guinn's new book on Henry Kissinger, and the title was, you know, "Welcome Back to Kissinger's World," because we really need a good dose of Kissingerian realism here to deal with the Chinese.
Well, Shell has been writing. He runs the U.S.-China program for the Asia Society, and he's been writing about the end of, what was it, the end of engagement, I think was the name of his recent article, about how what started with Kissinger is now in reverse and has to be stopped because collaboration on things like climate change require the U.S. and China to work together.
Absolutely. And not to mention what we're all going through right now, which is this, you know, the so-called
pandemic, yeah,
as Trump likes to call it. Yeah. You need a deeper level of cooperation and, frankly, trust. And I don't know, if it had been a different president, if it had been Biden instead of Trump, might the Chinese share their data earlier on COVID? Perhaps, you know, we would like to think so. So, it's No.
But there are also questions about, how would I say, the balance between individual freedom and collective responsibility, speaking from the other side of the pendulum. When we have no restriction on guns, I'm free to do what I want, but you're not free to not get shot by me.
Right.
Alternatively, I'm free to run around without a mask, but I can be unmindful of infecting you. Well, perhaps the Chinese or other systems, even Australia, New Zealand, which imposed a much greater lockdown, have done a much better job of handling this, done much less damage to their fiscal capacity in the long run.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of architectural questions related to, as you talked about Manker Olson earlier on, the logic of collective action. Collective action is not some little thing that's 1/6 of 1% of what's going on. It's a much bigger challenge. And the stability and organization of collective action is a challenge we're seeing in, how do you say, through many windows of dysfunction right now.
Yes. Well, I mean, if you want to stay on the international scene again, yes, other countries responded better. I think personally that, you know, Trump should have declared a national emergency and used some of the powers he had at hand to institute partial lockdowns and mandatory face mask wearing and so forth. He didn't. It was actually kind of, you know, contra the impression that Trump is a would-be fascist. I mean, he had a chance to seize power, more power than he really did. So it's interesting that he didn't do that, leaving it all up to the states and then leading to 300,000 American deaths so far. But
on the other side, I can't imagine that wave of that pandemic rolling over a president who's facing re-election, knowing what it's going to do to the economy.
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, maybe it was naive in the beginning of just wishing it wasn't there, wishing it would go as an act of denial. But I agree with you 100%. As it's even by February, March, it was obvious that we were, we had a, what they call a tiger by the tail, yeah, that we had to deal with.
Well, I can assure you that Donald Trump will go to his grave insisting he was, if not the greatest, one of the greatest American presidents. And was sabotaged by the Chinese and the China virus, as well as what he's still calling a rigged election. This is a guy who will never admit that he made any of these mistakes. It just doesn't seem to be in his nature. He's obviously a pathological narcissist who I think just never really grew up.
Yeah, that may well be. So let's turn to the kind of coming down the stretch here.
Yeah.
I just persuaded Joe Biden to appoint you as the architect of the first 100 days because you understand the healing, you understand the foreign policy, and you understand the economics, as you've demonstrated over the last 46 minutes. What do you roll out? What's your picture look like in that first 100 days to convince America that we're on a different and better track?
First of all, what you need most urgently is a repeat of the $2 trillion plus COVID rescue plan. You need more moratoriums on, you know, mortgage default, loan default, and then to be followed up by massive deficit spending, which we can afford. As I said, I think I said earlier, interest rates are going to remain very low. You don't have the crowding out problem that economists feared in the past. You're sort of heading toward the zero bound, and inflation is not going to be a concern for, I think, quite a while. There's a lot of economists who 10 years ago thought we were going to be in a horrible inflationary environment because of what happened after the financial crisis. It didn't happen. So you need to push, and a lot of it has to be on spending on public welfare, public goods. That's what you need, jobs. We desperately need, you know, infrastructure spending, as everybody agrees on both sides of the aisle, crumbling bridges and roads. I mean, all of this creates jobs, it creates equity, social equity. And I would, you know, if I were Joe Biden's advisor, I'd probably get to the point where he was slamming the door in my face because I would be repeating myself until I was red in the face, that this is what you have to do. And I think that he pretty much knows that. The only real question is how politically viable it will be given the setup on Capitol Hill. And of course, to add to that, I mean, that was just the economic situation. You need, you know, a full-scale reparation of relations with our allies, which of course we're going to get. I mean, Joe Biden is definitely an Atlantic Alliance guy. There's no question about that. He's going to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord and negotiate further deals. He has talked about rejoining the TPP under different circumstances, although there's some question of whether he can beat the expiration date. But and then, of course, you know, he will be trying to negotiate a new relationship with Russia and nuclear arms reduction. The new START agreement expires, I think, only a few days into the next term, the next President Biden. I think they're going to try to find a way to revive that. So, you know, across the board, a lot of activism, friendliness toward allies, and attention to an underclass, middle class that's still suffering and on the front line, suffering literally now on the front lines of this pandemic.
Well, I would nominate the 89-year-old genius Daniel Ellsberg to be a special assistant to the arms reduction. Having just, I just made a 3-part video with him after reading his book, The Doomsday Machine. Yeah. And what he makes very clear is if you resisted some of the political economic pressures from the military-industrial complex related to modernization of weapons, you could use that fiscal policy to support a Green New Deal and make the world safer in both in two dimensions. And while I know Daniel's older, he's still sharp as a tack. Yeah. But I do think his book, The Doomsday Machine, is about another pillar of global risk alongside climate change that we really should be dealing with. And Biden may, because of his experience working in and around foreign policy in Russia, he might be the man to pick that up.
Well, you know, I hope so. I tend to be something of an optimist on nuclear nonproliferation, having covered it since the Clinton administration. You know, right after the Cold War, when everything was in turmoil, you know, some arms experts thought you might get 20 to 30 nuclear countries, countries that would try to develop nuclear arms. And we still have really only nine, including North Korea, and if you include Iran's program as well. And I think that's a good sign. I mean, it's a very expensive task, and it risks becoming an international pariah to develop nuclear weapons. But at the same time, I agree with I think what you just said in terms of reorienting just our budget money toward more important things than giant nuclear arsenals.
And I'm, by the way, not advocating complete elimination of nuclear arsenals, because they do play a deterrent role. But the sheer scale of them is what Ellsberg talks about as, along with flaws in a command and control structure, is something that could, lead to the extermination of mankind through the obliteration of the upper atmosphere and inducing what's called a nuclear winter.
Yeah.
People wouldn't so much die from the explosion as they would die from starvation in the next ice age.
I know that there are concerns among nuclear experts like Bob Gallucci that too much is being left to AI now, and you get one of those science fiction nightmare scenarios of the machines taking over in some accidental way. And that is scary. And equally scary is, frankly, the Middle East going nuclear. And I supported the Iran nuclear deal, which I pray that they will be able to get back to, despite all the new violations we're seeing from Iran right now. I just think it's the only way to avoid a nuclear arms race in the Middle East that could go on for decades and cause exactly the kind of accidental horrors that you're referring to.
Well, Mike, we covered a lot of ground today in, in your career with foreign policy, domestic policy, watching Washington closely. You've been a tremendous lens and a tremendous, what you might call, record of what this country's done and evolved for better or for worse over, since the time you and I met, which was college age.
Yeah.
But I want to thank you for joining me today. Maybe when we turn the corner in the spring, we start to see some of these things being actualized. We've gotten beyond the Georgia election and Inauguration Day. We could meet again and take the temperature once more. But I just, for today, I want to thank you for being here. And and say, I guess you asked me about quoting musical lyrics. There's a song by the Police called "I'll Be Watching You." Every breath you take.
Yeah.
Every move you make, I'll be watching.
One
you.
Of my.
Well, I think when you walk down the streets in Washington, that's what the people in Congress, in the Senate, in the administration, in the courts should be humming, because you'll be watching them.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed our talk.
I did too. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.